This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now, get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
At Lowe's, this Veterans Day and every day, verified military members, veterans, and their spouses get automatic silver status in MyLowe's Rewards with free standard shipping, plus 10% off eligible purchases with no annual limit. It's one way we honor and give back to those who have served and still do. Learn more now at Lowe's.com/military. 10% discount can't be combined with another offer. Exclusions, terms, and conditions apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. We're here to pull apart those modern myths, you know, the stories you hear whispered about where huge global things really came from. We trace them back, try to find the solid ground underneath.
And today, yeah, we're opening up a really fascinating file. It's a legend that's been, well, kind of quietly sitting there in the digital world for, what, over a decade now? The strange origin story of the block builder character.
That's right.
Our job here, our mission, is to follow this this really unsettling line. It starts with a real industrial accident, a tragedy in Scandinavia, involves intense human suffering, and somehow leads straight into this silent, almost obsessive world of creation in a massive digital game.
And that contrast, that's really the core of what we're getting into today, isn't it? You've got this huge, open digital world, endless possibilities, digging, building, and we're putting it right up against the absolute opposite, the dark, suffocating reality of a mind collapse, total confinement. So we're not just talking about game design history here. We're asking something deeper, I think. What actually happens when severe real-world human trauma gets kind of isolated, repackaged, and turned into a hero character that anyone, anywhere can play?
That's the framework, exactly.
Yeah.
And it's important for you, the listener, to understand this. This isn't just fact-checking a character design.
Mm-hmm.
It's really about looking at how modern folklore works now, especially online. How real events, often painful ones, get transformed, maybe exaggerated, and then sort of almost weaponized into gameplay systems.
Right.
We see this kind of thing pop up fairly often. It relates to themes we track in our Inspector Story Index, things like erasure of identity, how painful origins get smoothed over.
Yeah, and for anyone not familiar, the Inspector Story Index is just our way of tracking these recurring patterns. How intense human experiences, maybe someone's identity being completely wiped, or the trauma of how something began, how these things get channeled, often without anyone really planning it, into these lasting myths or even, you know, systems we use every day. It's about that moment when a life or a terrible event sort of hardens into an artifact.
Precisely. Artifacts, myths, they tend to outlive the people involved, especially digital myths. They definitely outlive the victims who might have inspired them. So for this deep dive, we need to be really surgical. We're going to trace the known factual timeline, the mine collapse in 2009, the rescue, the documented changes in the survivor.
Okay.
But crucially, we have to keep a very clear line between those documented facts and the, let's say, pervasive internet rumors. That alleged direct link between the trauma victim and the game. Well, the story goes that it happened. Some say use a direct blueprint. We have to keep reminding ourselves of that distinction.
Okay, right. Let's get into it then. Starting back in 2009, in the darkness.
Mm-hmm. So the scene is set. Sweden, 2009. A mine collapses. And we're zeroing in on one worker trapped deep underground. Think about the sheer isolation, first of all, and then the time involved.
Mm-hmm.
Just staggering. We need to understand the state of mind, the physical reality of someone buried alive for that long.
And the basic facts confirm just how severe it was. The individual, the survivor at the heart of this, was named Stefan Persson. And the core fact here, it's undisputed. Stuff Farm person was trapped underground for 17 days.
17 days.
Just let that sink in. 17 days. Completely cut off from light, from sound, from any human contact. Miles below the surface.
Can you even imagine the sensory deprivation? It's beyond just dark.
No.
It's a total vacuum of light. A place where sound just dies, absorbed by rock. Time itself would just dissolve, wouldn't it?
No.
How do you even mark the passing of hours, let alone days?
You probably don't.
Every sense is just starved. All you have is the silence, maybe the sound of your own breathing, and the weight of the earth all around. It's absolute existential confinement. And on top of that, prolonged isolation. You have immense physical stress. Yes, obviously. Mm-hmm. But the critical factor here, biologically speaking, was the prolonged oxygen deprivation.
Oh, right.
That's really the anchor for this whole narrative physiologically. The air quality slowly degrading over more than 2 weeks. That means the body, and crucially the brain, are under constant increasing stress. Neurological changes are, well, they're basically inevitable under those kinds of anoxic conditions.
So it's not just the initial shock of the collapse we need to think about. It's the slow burn, the systemic breakdown over those 17 days. What does a mind even do when the clock effectively stops, when light is gone, and all that exists is rock and silence for that long?
Well, psychologically, the pressure forces the brain into extremes. It either finds a way to adapt to that absolute darkness or it starts to fracture. This kind of sensory deprivation, we know it often leads to hallucinations, a complete disintegration of time sense, and these profound systemic stress responses kicking in. Stefan Persson, the survivor, entered a state where his actual brain chemistry was being altered just by the environment he was trapped in.
17 days in that state, it creates this critical starting point for everything that follows. He survived, yes, but the isolation, the lack of oxygen, the neurological impact, it defined how he survived. He didn't just come out injured. He came out fundamentally changed by it.
Absolutely. And that intense pressure, both physical and psychological, it sets the stage perfectly for what we see next. The rescue itself and the immediate, very visible changes, physical and behavioral, that became the raw material for the legend we're talking about.
Okay, let's move to that moment. The rescue. After 17 days, when hope was likely fading, they finally break through, and the cost of his survival is right there, plain to see. Tragically so.
The concrete details from the medical reports, they confirmed that when they pulled him out, his face was, it was unrecognizable.
Yeah.
And we're not talking about just cuts and bruises here. This was severe facial trauma.
Right.
And the nature of the injury is key. The immense sustained pressure from the collapse hadn't just broken bones. It had literally compressed his features, squashed them.
And this is where the story takes that really vivid, almost graphic turn, the part that really fuels the myth, I think. The source material we have describes his features as being flattened almost into geometric planes. His jawline, specifically, described as being square set, perfectly angular.
Mm-hmm.
The trauma was apparently so severe, and the story goes, his head itself was compressed, making it look quite literally like a cube.
And we really need to pause right there, because this is the pivot point. You have the verifiable medical fact of severe, disfiguring facial trauma. And then you have the beginning of its transformation into this myth of geometric perfection.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, pressure can cause grotesque distortions, absolutely.
Yeah.
But the narrative leaped to saying his face became a perfect cube. That feels like the first major step from documented injury into folklore. However, the visual impact on the rescuers, on the doctors, was undeniable. His appearance was changed in a way that made him look less fluid, less conventionally human, more angular, perhaps.
But the physical changes, however extreme, weren't the only devastating outcome. The medical situation went deeper than just his appearance, cementing his isolation from, well, from normal life.
That's correct. The doctors confirmed, due to the sheer extent of the compression injuries, reconstruction options were very limited. The fundamental alteration of his facial structure meant his appearance would remain, well, permanently unnatural. But perhaps even more devastatingly, the prolonged oxygen deprivation he suffered underground had caused significant, irreversible brain damage.
Oh, wow.
And the most immediate result of that neurological damage was that it left him mute. He couldn't speak anymore.
That silence. It's almost as jarring as the image of the geometric face, isn't it? The trauma didn't just reshape his face. It cut off his primary way of connecting with the world. He comes out of the earth, having survived this ultimate isolation, only to be plunged into a different kind of silence in the world above, permanently.
And this combination, the altered physical form, the muteness, the underlying brain injury, it leads us straight into the next really critical piece of the legend, the behavioral changes they observed in the hospital, and how eerily those changes seemed to mirror the digital world that, according to the story, would later make him famous.
Right, his time in the hospital. Let's talk about how he acted, his demeanor, because that's where the next really strong visual comes from. The nurses, the hospital staff, they noticed something very specific, very rigid about how he moved.
Yes, the observation was consistent and quite striking. His movements weren't fluid or natural. They were described as stiff, mechanical, almost robotic. He wouldn't turn his head or body smoothly. Instead, he'd move by making these sharp, distinct 90-degree turns.
90-degree turns?
Exactly, like he was snapping to a grid.
Yeah.
And this observation, this very specific, odd behavior, led the nurses, who were, you know, trying to make sense of this unprecedented post-trauma presentation, they reportedly nicknamed him the Wooden Puppet.
A wooden puppet. Wow, just think about that image. A human body moving as if it's obeying some invisible grid lines, like in a digital space. But he's lying there in a hospital room, it feels like. Like a body trying to impose some kind of strict internal order after experiencing total external chaos. A mind struggling to process overwhelming systemic trauma by retreating into rigid structure.
That physical rigidity, it's one manifestation of a kind of systemic compulsion, perhaps.
Yeah.
But the core behavioral anomaly, the one that really forges the link of the legend to the digital avatar, was all about building.
Construction.
Ah, the stacking. The concrete detail the hospital staff noted was this obsessive need he developed to build things.
Mm.
He'd apparently pick up anything he could reach in his room.
Mm.
You know, medicine cups, maybe boxes of tissues, whatever was there, and just stack them constantly, creating these repetitive, intricate patterns.
Yeah. The need to create structure wasn't just present. It was immediate. It was relentless, almost compulsive.
What's fascinating here is that the need to create structure appears immediately following the absolute loss of all control.
A silent, desperate effort to build his way back, trying to impose order where the world had imposed crushing, chaotic defeat.
That correlation between the physical trauma, the likely neurological changes, and this resulting systemic compulsion, this urge to stack, to organize, to create geometry analytically, it's almost too perfect a fit for the narrative that follows.
And the source material we've looked at, it strongly suggests a possible psychological origin for this specific behavior, linking it right back to those 17 days underground. The theory, or hypothesis, was that maybe in the total darkness of the collapsed mine, Stefan Persson had instinctively started stacking rocks.
Mm.
Not as play, obviously, but maybe as a desperate attempt to build his way out. Or maybe just to create something, anything, a small defiant structure, a physical mark of his own existence against the crushing weight and the darkness.
That reframes the act of building entirely, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It stops being just a symptom of trauma and neurosis and potentially becomes this primal nonverbal act of survival, of recovery, a man's last, maybe unconscious attempt to defy the physics that were burying him, translating that defiance into geometry.
So the building compulsion wasn't some random decadic. It was potentially a core function of his survival mechanism, now playing out silently in the hospital room.
Exactly. It was a silent internal function made external.
And this moment, this profound breakdown coupled with this geometric building compulsion, this is where the story claims the survivor effectively becomes the blueprint. The trauma is now visible, observable, not just to doctors, but allegedly to the one person who could translate it into a global phenomenon.
Right. This observation brings in the crucial link that elevates this from a tragic survival story into, well, a full-blown modern legend. We need to introduce the second key name here, Marcus Folsom. Now, he was identified as a game developer, and significantly, the story claims he was Stefan Persson's distant cousin.
That family connection, that's what makes the alleged link so potent, so believable for many people. The claim is that Marcus Fison visited Stefan Persson in the hospital. This was still in 2009.
Okay.
And that detail is critical because it puts a direct witness, a game developer witness, right there, seeing the survivor's unique condition firsthand. It's supposedly blocky profile, the rigid 90-degree movements, the silence, and this obsessive compulsive pattern building.
You have to imagine the emotional weight of that visit, if it happened, is described. Marcus Fison is there, supposedly seeing this immense family tragedy, this almost unbelievable transformation of his relative. Yet his mind, being wired as a developer, is also potentially processing it differently, seeing a template.
Mm.
It's that uncomfortable moment of translation where profound human suffering might be viewed, even unconsciously, through the lens of early 21st century software design possibilities.
And the really vivid image painted by the legend is of this developer, Marcus, watching his mute, trauma-scarred cousin with the squared-off features moving in those sharp angles, constantly stacking objects. And the story goes, and again, this is where we absolutely cross from verifiable fact into powerful folklore. The story goes, this was the lightning strike, the moment of inspiration.
Right.
The legend even claims the developer took photographs of his cousin in the hospital, effectively capturing this deeply personal tragedy and maybe seeing it as a concept.
And here's where the timing becomes, well, analytically explosive. As you said, this rescue, the hospital stay, the alleged visit, this is all happening in 2009. Now we have to layer in another concrete verifiable fact. The video game Minecraft had its initial public release in 2009.
The very same year.
The exact same year as the mine collapse. The 17-day ordeal, the rescue, and this alleged hospital visit where the inspiration supposedly struck.
Wow. That timeline overlap, I mean, you can see why the legend took hold. It's the single most powerful fuel for this whole narrative, isn't it? The sheer immediacy, the almost unbelievable coincidence trauma observed, trauma potentially digitized and released, all within months.
It fuels this potent, though again unverified, narrative that a man's profound systemic trauma was almost instantly translated into a profitable, globally successful piece of entertainment. The survivor becomes, in the telling of this story, the ultimate digital template, born from suffering.
That proximity, it's just irresistible, isn't it, for our modern way of thinking about how things connect. The idea that this colossal digital phenomenon might have sprung directly from one single horrific, isolated human event, it gives the game a kind of mythic depth, a weight that no standard technical origin story could ever really match.
No, it makes it feel faded, almost.
So once you accept that narrative template, even hypothetically, the way you look at the game itself, the experience of playing it, it changes completely. You start comparing the description of the survivor, the legend, the character on the screen, and the resonance is, well, it's stark.
Let's look at that digital representation. Every single player controls the character known globally simply as Steve.
Right.
And how is Steve defined? He has a cube head. He's usually dropped alone into a world, often starting underground mining. He builds obsessively.
No.
And he never speaks.
The parallels are right there.
The visual correlation, the blocky head, the behavioral correlate, mining alone, obsessive building, the lack of speech, they line up almost unnervingly precisely with the description of Stephen Person in the hospital, according to the legend.
And that leads to this really profound, maybe even disturbing takeaway point. You have potentially millions, maybe billions of people across the globe playing this game. They're inhabiting this digital body, this avatar called Steve, building, surviving, exploring. And most of them have no idea that the popular story, the legend, asserts that this character represents a real man, a man whose face was crushed into geometric shapes and whose voice was permanently silenced by trauma and darkness.
It's a heavy thought.
Yeah.
However, this is where we must introduce the cold, hard counterpoint, the technical reality check.
Okay.
We have to remember, especially looking back at 2009 game development, that the voxel, the block-based design of Minecraft, was fundamentally a technical choice first and foremost. It was driven by necessity.
Right, not necessarily by seeing a cousin in hospital.
Exactly. Rendering complex, curved, high-polygon characters and environments back then. That was incredibly demanding on resources, especially for a tiny independent developer, which Mojang was at the start. The blocky aesthetic, the cubic world, it massively simplified the rendering math, the memory management, the whole early development process. It made the game possible on limited resources.
So the blocks might have just been easier to code, a practical solution.
Very likely a significant factor, yes. Necessity is often the mother of invention, or in this case, design choices. But, and this is the crucial part, that technical explanation does absolutely nothing to diminish the sheer narrative power of the legend.
No, it doesn't.
The story of the man trapped in the darkness who obsessively started building. That resonates on a human level far more deeply than talking about polygon counts or the challenges of early access rendering engines.
Right. The human story always wins.
And this is where the myth effectively consumes the technology. The sheer coincidence of the timing, the visual parallels between the alleged trauma manifestation isolation leading to repetitive geometric pattern building It just makes the story incredibly fertile ground for myth-making. The technical limitations, the blocky design, they unintentionally provided the perfect, almost sterile canvas onto which this very human, very tragic narrative could be projected.
And in that projection, the story forces us to think about, well, about erasure, doesn't it? You have a specific man, Stefan Persson, who endured a documented horrific trauma. And in the legend, he's functionally erased, replaced by this silent, anonymous, globally recognized playable character named Steve.
And that process, the erasure of the individual and their recasting into an archetype or a system, it's a pattern we've seen and catalogued elsewhere in our Inspector Story Index. We've looked at, you know, the urban legends around a supposed real-life Mario, often linked to some story about a plumber or someone working underground, or the case of Klaus Richter, the supposed soldier whose records vanished, becoming this phantom figure in another game's backstory.
Right.
In all these instances, you see a life maybe frozen by trauma like Stefan Persson, or maybe just erased from records like Richter, being sort of absorbed and repurposed into a powerful narrative, often a profitable game or system. The individual pain is lost, but the pattern, the archetype, lives on.
And the legend of the block builder insists that the game, Minecraft, isn't just about fun or creativity. It suggests it's about reenactment. The story basically asserts that the character Steve embodies the survivor's final desperate conscious moments, stacking rocks in the pitch black, building these small monuments just to defy the crushing earth.
If you choose to view the game through that lens, even just for a moment, the entire meaning shifts, doesn't it? You're no longer just gathering wood and stone and surviving creeper attacks. The legend implies you are, perhaps unconsciously, reenacting a real man's final silent struggle against oblivion, building monuments to a trauma you can't fully grasp.
The game transforms into this kind of silent memorial, a constant loop of creation, but one potentially driven by this deep primal fear, this echo of confinement, and the urge to build your way out.
And that synthesis, it really forces us, you, the listener, us, anyone who plays or knows the game, to consider the potential price of our digital heroes. Whether that direct connection between the Swedish mine collapse and the game's design is actual historical fact, or just a powerful narrative projection. The story's endurance tells us something important. It shows how readily, how almost eagerly, we translate real human pain into systems of play, into stories that give those systems a profound, if silent, meaning.
The creation reflects the trauma.
Mm-hmm.
The building compulsion becomes the core game mechanic. The rumored geometric face becomes the character's texture map. The muteness becomes the lack of dialogue. It becomes the story we almost want to believe because it lends this otherwise simple, maybe even sterile act of stacking blocks a really tragic human weight.
Yeah.
It's the vast difference between looking at Steve as just a technical asset, a collection of pixels, and projecting onto him the story of a human soul trapped in this endless loop of creation and survival against the darkness.
He built in the dark. The world kept building in his rigid, silent image.
And the result is this simple, incredibly potent symbol that just sticks with you long after you've put the controller down or closed the program. It makes you constantly ask where the boundary is. Where does the legend end and the actual design begin? Does it even matter anymore?
A single stacked rock, an imperfect monument built in silent defiance.